Okay, this is our shortened class, and as you can see from the outline, it was meant to cover last Tuesday and also today, and we got through point one, but we'll do a quick review of that and then continue. But having gone through all these responsibilities of the Pope, don't you feel bad for, I shouldn't say feel bad, but for a true Pope, do you imagine the responsibilities that he has? And there's no human checks or balances on a Pope. He has to be such a holy man. No wonder his official title is
Supreme
Pontiff, but if you were speaking to him, you would say Holy Father or? No, it's Your Holiness. A quick review here, and hopefully this recording is picking up, but for the Pope, his official title is His Holiness. Okay, for a cardinal, what would it be?
His Eminence.
And if you're speaking to him, Your Eminence. Okay, and then Archbishop. So be His Grace. Or if you're speaking to him, Your Grace. If you're in England, you would say, My Lord.
Wow.
Or His Lordship.
I know somebody who goes by.
I don't think by any lawful claim, but he goes by it, all right.
He's with his other
couple. Yeah. His Lordship, yes. Okay, and then Bishop is His Excellency.
What if you can't remember which title they have? What would you do? What would you say? Just hello.
No, well, you have to be. You have to remember the etiquette.
Before you know, go look it up.
You have to remember the etiquette.
Father is never wrong because he had to be a priest.
Well, yes, but it still would not be proper. You have to. Yeah. This is so you can never invoke ignorance down the road. Yeah, you have been instructed, forewarned, you're ready for anything. It's not a lot you have to remember here.
We don't have those others that we're at for a while.
Well, you don't see them that often.
Well, yes, if you don't see them often. Well, right now there's no Pope, so don't worry about that one. There's no cardinals. There's no archbishops.
Oh, well, hey.
Your Excellency, for any bishop. Interestingly, His Excellency is also the proper title for a prime minister of a country. You would say His Excellency, the prime minister of Italy, for example. So it's proper to do that. Also, governor of a state is His Excellency or Her Excellency.
If you were a bishop, would that make you feel uncomfortable for someone to call you that, or not?
Well, if that's his calling for somebody to be bishop, he just accepts that fact, and he's Your Excellency. Although I've noticed many people will say bishop. And that's, you know, on a day-to-day basis, the bishop interacts with seminarians, nuns. He teaches in high school. And Brother Thomas, you lived in Omaha. Don't they often say bishop, and they mean it very reverently? But that's not correct, technically.
No, but the bishop, or His Excellency, didn't like this calling, is it Your Excellency? So we just said bishop.
Well, but again, this is the correct way. You have been told what the correct way is. About lordship, I think that's only in England, and that's because of, you know, England is so filled with those titles of royalty still. So a bishop is considered a lord. As a matter of fact, any Anglican bishop is automatically in the House of Lords. So you see where that idea of lord, it's called the spiritual lord as opposed to the temporal lords. But may I also say, that's never a good idea to have a bishop who's supposed to be involved in spiritual matters being involved in politics. I mean, but that was a problem ever since Henry VIII said, I'm the head of the Church of England. And he mixed church and state up where they're not distinguishable. And remember, our Lord said, two different spheres. We've talked about this in class. Render to Caesar what is Caesar. Render to God what is God's. And many, St. Thomas of Becket, he was martyred because the king wouldn't keep his hands off the church. It doesn't mean they have to be against each other. They should be in harmony, but the church is supreme in spiritual matters or matters of faith and morals. The state is supreme in temporal matters. And that's the way it's supposed to be, in harmony with each other. Okay, so yes.
Do we have to acknowledge them as your lordship or whatever, even though they're not Catholic?
Well, right now there's no traditional Catholic bishops
in
England. So we wouldn't be using lordship. And I think you'd have to actually be in England.
Like if I was talking to somebody who was an Anglican or something, do I have to acknowledge?
No, because they're not even valid bishops. Okay. We're talking about Catholic bishops. But Anglicans, that they're...
Just call them Peter, or whatever the name is.
Well...
I wanted that too, you know, when you're socializing or something.
Yeah.
Somebody comes up to you, it's like, ask
that's an interest. That would be an interesting question. Yeah. What would you do?
Because I wouldn't be comfortable calling the pastor so-and-so.
I'm not sure. You know, what's interesting is in 1911, Pope St. Pius X sent a delegation to the coronation of King George, the 4th or 5th of England, 1911. Now, he was sending these clergy. As a matter of fact, Monsignor Pacelli was one of the members of this entourage, who later would become Pope Pius XII. They went to honor King George as the head of the government, but not as the head of the church. You see, the true church cannot acknowledge the Anglicans as the true church at all. Of course, after Vatican II, they go and have ecumenical services together. But isn't that interesting? Pope St. Pius X, as the sovereign of Vatican City State, or the church's temporal kingdom, sent this delegation. It was the proper thing to do.
A courtesy.
Yeah. See, the Pope has to he interacts with all of the Catholic world as their spiritual head, but he also, through his diplomats, interacts with all the governments of the world that want to have diplomatic relations with the Holy See. He has interactions with them as a temporal sovereign, because he is the king of the smallest country in the world. 108 acres, Vatican City State. So that's 1/6 of a square mile.
Wow.
Pretty small. As a matter of fact, here at the Mount, we have 300 acres, so we're almost three times bigger than the smallest country in the world, for purposes of comparison.
Are there any statistics on how many countries traditional Catholics are in?
How many traditional Catholics are there throughout the world? I would say almost every country in the world you could find traditional Catholics. And that's what makes us Catholic, right? Universal. Almost every country has people who say, you know, Vatican II veered off the right path. I want to hold to what the church taught before Vatican II. Okay, so let's, number one here in our outline, we looked at all these doctrinal points that the Pope is responsible for doing. He determines creeds, commands books for religious instruction, directs Catholic missions, prohibits books that are dangerous to faith or morals. He gives issues condemnations, false teachings. He interprets the natural law. He interprets the Bible. He clarifies church teaching. This is all part of that awesome duty and responsibility that a true pope has. Okay, so we're on to point number two. This is now about the liturgy of the church. So how does the pope exercise his supreme authority over the liturgy of the church? Letter A, the pope alone can prescribe the liturgical services employed in the church. If a doubt should occur in regard to the ceremonial of the liturgy, a bishop may not settle the point on his own authority, but has to have recourse to Rome. So I think you can see this, that in past ages, the Catholic Church was more decentralized. Local bishops had more power. They could do more things. But as time went on, it made sense to centralize more of that authority in Rome. And the latest set of laws, or actually it was a wonderful codification of law, the 1917 Code of Canon Law, did a wonderful job of sifting through hundreds and hundreds of years of laws that had accumulated, you know, getting rid of useless laws, clarifying, changing. So that really centralized power much more than, well, significantly more than in past centuries. By the way, it was Pope St. Pius X who started this codification of canon law. And it was made, but he died before it was finished. So it was Pope Benedict XV who finished this codification process. This was like 15 years of work. It was one of the things on his mind when he became Pope in 1903. And he died, as a matter of fact, it was August 20th, 1914. So most of the work was already done. It was promulgated on the Feast of Pentecost, 1917, but it became obligatory by 1918. So it was such a huge work that the whole church was given a year to get conformed to it.
Was the Mass part of that, the actual writing?
Actually, no, the Mass is not, liturgical law is purposely kept out of this. It's just liturgical law is too complex to try to have it in this book. So I think it's Canon 1 or Canon 2 says, all liturgical laws are codified somewhere else. You won't find them here. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. And so instead of the canon law being like this, it would be like that if we try to include all the liturgical laws of the church. So a lot of wisdom in the church, but imagine that a whole year before it became effective. The normal guideline is whenever the Pope makes a rule or a law, everybody has 3 months to get in line with it, to make sure that they do all the necessary adjustments. But this was a massive mess. And of course, this came right during this tremendous upheaval, World War I. And of course, that's when Our Lady appeared at Fatima, 1917. What a pivotal year. Now, no doctrines were changed in this code of canon law, but it was an enormous amount of work. I can't begin to express how difficult this was. But it was a necessary thing. Pope St. Pius X had it on his mind when he got elected, like as I said, in 1903. And there it was. And it spells out there what the Pope has to authorize, what local bishops can do. It spells out a lot of things, but it is quite centralized.
Do we have any canon lawyers anymore?
Canon lawyers, I know they're all Vatican II. Oh. But, you know, every seminarian studies canon law before ordination. Doesn't make him a canon lawyer. I've been studying it ever since before and after ordination. I'm not a canon lawyer either. You have to get an official degree, just like, I'm trying to think, I know there's a licentiate, which is like a bachelor's degree in canon law, but then there's the doctorate in canon law. And all the licentiates and doctorates, they're all in the new code of 1983. Which has heresy in it, of course. It's 1983 Code of Canon Law is all Vatican II. It absolutely included Vatican II, so they're done with this. But we're not. Well, not authoritatively. You know, in canon law, the only one that can interpret the Pope's law is the Pope himself or whoever he delegates. So this is why there's sometimes disagreements among traditional Catholics. But they're not on doctrine. They're just, how does this law apply in a situation where we haven't had a true Pope for 60 years? So there can be legitimate debate on that. You know, and if we had a Pope, then there's no debate. You just say, well, Holy Father, what do we do? So this is where in charity we have to respect each other, realize, you know, if I have a disagreement with a priest on a point of canon law, I can't bind him and he can't bind me. He doesn't have the authority, I don't have the authority. When we get together in our priest meetings, we go over many times points of canon law, and we come to a we have a very good consensus among CMRI priests. This is how we apply this law in today's circumstance. So very beneficial. It's not good for a priest to be on his own. Really, every priest has to be part of a group. Just like in normal times, the priest is not a loner. He's part of a diocese. He's subject to a bishop. There's a lot of safety and security in that. So we still follow the mind of the church, even though we're not living in normal times. Okay, so the Pope has to approve liturgical changes. Letter B, institution and abrogation of festivals. It used to be that bishops could decide what feasts they would have in their diocese, at least to some extent, but now it has to be approved by Rome. Okay? So I'll try to give you an example of that. You all know who St. Gerard Majella is, a Redemptorist lay brother. And we have a St. Gerard Guild. He had a special mission as a lay brother to pray for women who were having difficult pregnancies. And through his prayers, they did well despite their difficulties. Many miracles happened. So he's a patron of that. And he was a very holy lay brother. I mean, he's saintly, known for his virtues. So there's a St. Gerard, but Father Gerard, our own priest, he cannot offer the Mass of St. Gerard because that's not an approved feast for this diocese. He may be able to do a votive Mass, but I'm not even sure about that. But I can't, because it's not approved. It's not an approved feast. I can pray to him devotionally, but a pope did not authorize this feast to be observed throughout the church. You see? So there, it's more centralized. We've gotten more centralized, definitely, from this very pivotal year. Okay? Solemn canonization of a saint. It used to be that bishops could canonize or do some kind of a process of approval for a canonization, but for the last 1,000 years, only the Pope can declare a saint. Okay? And it makes sense, because that's considered an infallible act. You know, when a true pope canonizes somebody, not only does he say you may, but he commands all Catholics to honor so-and-so as a person of heroic virtue who is in heaven. That's a canonization. Letter D, he alone gives to anyone the privilege of a private chapel where Mass may be said. It's a technical point. I'm not going to worry about that one right now. Letter E, he dispenses the treasury of the church, and the grant of plenary indulgences is reserved to him. So the Pope has to say that you get a partial indulgence or a plenary indulgence. Only the Holy See can decide that. And a lot of these things are not done personally by the Pope, but it's done, for example, through the Congregation of the Sacred Penitentiary, or there may even be a Congregation of Indulgences. I'm not sure on that. Probably not. I think it's the Sacred Penitentiary where, in using the authority the Pope gives them, the cardinal of this congregation says, so in so many days, indulgence is granted for this prayer. So sometimes you can get 300 days, sometimes you can get 3 years, sometimes you can get 7 years, sometimes you can get plenary indulgences. All these have to be approved and put in place by a true pope. Once they're put in place, they continue. All right? Which is why on All Souls Day, what do? You can go into church and make visits for the holy souls. You know, six Our Fathers, Hail Marys, and Glory Bees, be sorry for your sins, go to confession and communion, and you can make as many visits as you wish, you know, and you can get a plenary indulgence for our soul in purgatory with each of those visits. Okay. All right. Letter F, he can give priests the power to confirm. I would change that to he can authorize a priest to confirm. I have the power to confirm, but I don't have permission to use it, at least not on a normal basis. So if I did it, I'd be committing a big sin, and it would not be a valid confirmation because a true pope has not authorized it. But Pope Pius XII authorized parish priests to give confirmation if somebody was going to die before the bishop could get there. So that means...
In which case, you're authorized to act.
Yeah, there has to be an authorization. So the priests have the power, the church doesn't let them use it. Yes, brother.
What about the Mexican priests who baptize and confirm?
Yeah, I don't know if they do that on a regular basis.
I've heard that from...
Yeah, if they do, it's because of a permanent indulge that was given from the time of Pope Pius XII. Also, I know Eastern Rite priests Eastern Rite priests, on the day of baptism, they confirm the baby and they give the baby for Holy Communion. They're authorized to do that. It's not our custom.
The precious blood.
Yeah, they receive under both species. So they I don't know how they do it. And it's leavened bread, so it's a little cube of bread that was changed into the body of our Lord, and then he puts that inside a chalice, the chalice which has the precious blood, and he puts it I'd be worried, like, what if the baby spits it out?
Yeah, or just babies.
But I guess it's been working for centuries, and they do it. I just have never seen it happen.
Babies don't like things that taste bitter, like wine.
Well, we don't know.
I don't know what to say. I've never seen it. I just know that it's done. I don't know how it's done. I don't know how frequently. I would imagine if it's definitely up to the discretion of the priest. If the baby's a little sick or throwing up or or something, obviously he wouldn't do it. So. And then they don't receive Holy Communion again until they make, you know, start receiving under when they have the age of reason. Okay. He can also, the Pope can authorize priests to bless the oil of the sick and the oil of catechumens, but not Holy Chrism. Only the bishop can do that. And then he can establish impediments, durament and impedient impediments to matrimony. So this is not something that changes very much. There's a list of impediments to valid marriages. It's been around for a long time. You know, a true Pope would not be just establishing impediments just for the sake of doing it. So that list is pretty standard, has been around for a long time. Okay, number three, the legislative power of the Pope. He can legislate for the whole church with or without the assistance of a general council. Is that a lot of power in one man's hands?
Which direction is the wind blowing?
What do you mean by that?
Well, he could change his mind.
Well, he could.
The direction of the wind.
Yeah, he could, but then you need a really holy, wise, prudent, learned man in that position who won't do things on the whim, you know. But it's not like Congress. You know, Congress goes through a very lengthy process of passing a law. It has to pass, it goes through, you know, all kinds of discussion, then it has to go to committees, and then the House of Representatives has to approve it, and then the Senate has to approve it, and then it doesn't become law until the President signs it into law. Very lengthy process. And if you wanted to change the Constitution, you need a far lengthier process. What's the process for adding an amendment to the Constitution?
All the states have to amend it.
Yes, not only does it have to pass House of Representatives, Senate, President, but three-fourths of the state legislatures has to approve it. In other words, the Founding Fathers made it it's not impossible, but they made it extraordinarily difficult to change the Constitution, which gives it a lot more stability.
Right.
But do you remember the Equal Rights Amendment that was pushed very strongly in the 1970s?
Yes.
By the liberals?
Mm-hmm.
That was passed by Congress. It was signed by the president, but it died because not enough state legislatures approved it. And the liberals wanted it to pass. The conservatives said, no, this is going to cause a lot more harm than good. So it died. And that amendment was never put into the Constitution. The latest, one of the most recent amendments is that 18-year-olds can vote. And that was passed during the Vietnam War. So it went through that very lengthy process, and it succeeded. Okay, I'm running out of time. I have to leave here pretty soon. Letter B, it's up to the Pope to convoke a council. Letter C, he has full authority to interpret, alter, abrogate both his laws and those established by his predecessors. But here's an important point to make. A Pope can change past laws, but he cannot change doctrine. That's the biggest thing for us to remember. And people get this wrong. When they see all these heretical changes of Bergoglio, they'll say, well, a Pope can change whatever he wants. And we say, no, he can't. He cannot change doctrine. He can change laws. He can change discipline, but he can't change law, divine. He can't change doctrine.
If you can, in as rapidly as possible, explain quo primum was that Ebola?
Yes, quo primum.
And it's my understanding that Ebola's cannot be changed by subsequent popes.
Well, can quo primum be changed? As a matter of fact, it was changed by true popes. Pope Pius V said, nobody can change this missal. But that when new saints were canonized, their feasts were added, and that's changing. But here's another example. Pope Pius XII changed the Holy Week liturgy, and it's in there. What Pope St. Pius V said is that not even a cardinal can change this papal bull.
Right.
But he knew he couldn't bind a future pope. We used to think that we have to make a distinction here. We have to distinguish the doctrine can never change. They changed the doctrine with Vatican II. They made it into a meal. You know, instead of emphasizing it's the renewal of the sacrifice of Calvary. Mm-hmm. So they changed the doctrine. That's where they went wrong. But the discipline of the church, can the Pope make adjustments to the Mass? He can. A true Pope can.
He can.
We used to think it could not be, but then how do you answer it how do you answer the objection? Well, Pope Pius XII made changes to the Holy Week liturgy.
Isn't the consecration?
Well, the Holy Week liturgy was, you know, instead of having the vigil mass in the Holy Saturday morning, he says, do it in the evening, or better yet, wait till midnight.
Yeah.
You know, and he reduced the 12 prophecies to 4 prophecies. He made changes.
Well, then they changed the
scripture. You see, the Pope can change accidentals of the Mass. He can't change the essence of the Mass. But that's the problem with the new Mass. It changed the essence of the Mass.
The wording, is that what you're saying?
The wording, yes. They Protestantized the Mass. Pope Pius XII did not Protestantize it at all. He simply, if I could give an example. If I have a standing tree, I can do one of two things. I can chop so much of it down that there's basically a stump left. Or I can prune the branches. If I prune it, is it still the same tree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I chop it to pieces, is it the same tree?
Yes.
Not really.
No. So that's the analogy I would use. The new Mass, they literally took an axe to it. Changed it that much. Chopped it, most of it down. Just left pieces here and there. It's not the same thing anymore. Pope Pius XII pruned it. He can do that. But when we were first starting to deal with the changes of Vatican II, we thought that quo primum was all we needed. So initially, it was our go-to position. But we have to be honest, you know, even other popes besides Pope Pius XII made some minor changes to the missal also. He wasn't the only one.
And it's our job to point out or to understand the parts
Understand
the parts of the Mass that were chopped up.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what we were what we've done in some, last year I know we were focusing on that. I mean, they have the photo of Paul VI with the six Protestant ministers that were consulted on the rewrite of the Mass. So when the Protestants took out, said, yeah, take out this and this, we don't like this theology that you have. So it's apples and oranges, two completely different things. Okay, very quickly, I'm going to stop here in 3 minutes. He can dispense individuals from the obligation of all purely ecclesiastical laws, letter E. He can dispense from vows, he can dispense from vows if he feels that, there's a justification. There are some vows that can only be dispensed by the Holy See, not even by a bishop, or even much less a priest. Okay, number four, in virtue of his supreme judicial authority, major causes are reserved to him. So, for example, if the president of a country has a particular issue regarding marriage, you know, his local bishop would not be the one to take care of it. The Pope said, I'm dealing with it. I can say, I'll deal with this, nobody else may. So that's called reserving a major case to himself. Appellate jurisdiction, every Catholic, every priest, every religious, every bishop has the, can appeal to the Pope. He can go to the highest authority. Okay, letter C, he can inflict censures either by judicial sentence or by general laws. And that's a pretty serious matter when a pope personally excommunicates somebody. It happened to a bishop in England who was consecrating bishops, you know, without papal authority. Pope St. Pius X personally excommunicated him, and that person became
old Catholic?
Well, that's what he was doing. He became an old Catholic, but he became a vitandus, which is like the highest degree of repulsion. Not only were you excommunicated, you got excommunicated by the Pope, and you are a vitandus, and guess what? If he walked into the church where the Mass is being said, the Mass is supposed to be stopped until he's expelled. If you are personally excommunicated by the Pope. That's if it can be done. You know, that's how serious a stain this person incurs who would, you know. And you can be sure that if he gets excommunicated personally by the Pope, it's for the most grave crimes against God or the church.
Can that be undone?
Oh, yeah. Excommunications are medicinal. As soon as that bishop, that renegade bishop, repented, he would be forgiven. You know, it doesn't work that way in civil law. You've got people who repent right after they commit the crime, but that doesn't get them out of 10 years in jail or whatever it is. You know, he's not to do it. You know, the church is more merciful that way with the medicinal penalty. Okay, number five, a supreme governor of the church. It is his to nominate to the bishops. I mean, you cannot be, may not lawfully become a bishop unless the Pope, true Pope, authorizes it. But the reason we've been doing it is because there's no Pope to ask. But there's plenty of precedent for this. If there's no Pope, the church has to continue on. So that's why Archbishop Took, Archbishop Lefebvre, Bishop Carmona, Bishop Pibrunus, Bishop Dolan, Bishop Sandberg, they've consecrated bishops because of this part, it can definitely be done in extraordinary situations. But if we get a true pope, then everybody has to submit, no questions asked. Okay, B, he can establish dioceses. When was our diocese established? Diocese of Spokane, I've talked about this recently.
Early part of the 20th century.
Oh, I was looking for an exact date.
Oh,
And I lost my my. What I do with the dry erase pen? Somehow it disappeared. I think it was December 17th, 1913, but it was not announced, it wasn't promulgated till, I put this in the bulletin, who remembers? February 11th, 1914. That's Feast of Our Lady of Lourdes. And Our Lady of Lourdes is our patroness for this diocese. And again, he died in August 1914. So, and he personally appointed the first bishop. He knew Bishop Augustine Schinner. Okay. He can approve new religious orders. The bishops have to report to him personally at least every 3 years. They have to show up in Rome, make a report of their diocese to the Pope. And he has the right to communicate with anybody. One of the worst crimes that's punished in canon law is when somebody interferes with somebody having access to the appeal to the Holy See. And then, anyway, we're going to have to stop there. There's much more, but I think we had a very nice list here. I really appreciated this from the Catholic Encyclopedia, made for a very